This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to a special edition of the NBA Team Podcast over on placetobenation.com. There's a lot of sports podcasts that we do on the Place to Be Nation. We do Place to Be Nation Sports Lounge with Roger Morissette. We do The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G. I've just started out our podcast. We're doing all of our daily previews for the Central Division and this division and that division, all the other divisions that for the regular season. And I just wanted to bring in a special edition because along with all of the NBA hoopla, you get also a lot of book releases that happen in the beginning of November. And one of the books that's being released is a book that really fascinated me when I saw it come out because I've never seen a book exactly about the awfulness of a team. And the person that I'm going to be speaking with chose the right one. The title of the book is called Perfectly Awful, The Philadelphia 76ers Horrendous and Hilarious 1972-73 Season. That is the detailing of a season in which the Philadelphia 76ers were the only team in an 82-game season to win less than 10 games, which is, even in futility, quite the accomplishment. So who is the writer that wrote this book? Well, it's the man I'm speaking to right now, and he has quite the resume. It is pretty amazing, and I'm so glad I'm going to talk to him. He has been writing since the early 70s, but it doesn't start there because he was a basketball player in his college days out at, I'm trying to find the name of the college.
Hunter College.
Were there any other alumni besides you, maybe Ron Rothstein?
That I did what?
Was Ron Rothstein one of your,
No.
The man I'm speaking with is Charlie Rosen. He's written several books. One of them, he's written, co-written two with Phil Jackson. He's done quite a few novels as well. Some of the novels include A Mile Above the Rim, Barney Poland's Game, No Blood, No Foul, Scout's Honor. He just released one this year called Sammy Wong, All-American. How are you doing, Mr. Rosen?
I'm doing pretty good, I think.
Where are you sitting at right now?
I am in a leather chair in an office that doubles as a guest bedroom.
So
I'm really comfortable.
You're really comfortable? And is that out in the New York area?
Yes, in upstate New York. Actually, we live in a place called Accord, and we had a house fire last January. So while our house is being rebuilt, we're living in a rental in Kerhonkson, New York, which is the kind of place, if you haven't been there, you've never heard of it.
Well, I'm betting that's not too far from the area that you grew up in. Did you grow up in the Bronx?
In the Bronx, yeah. It's about 100 miles north of New York.
Okay. And so the first thing I wanted to get out of the way, because I said it right at the top, is that you're obviously very close friends with Phil Jackson. You co-wrote the book More Than a Game with him. You also co-wrote a book with him back in the mid-70s called Maverick. And so a lot of people in the NBA circles know your relationship with Phil Jackson. He's come back into the limelight in recent months because he is now the team president for the New York Knicks, which is not too far from the area you're at now and maybe your old stomping grounds. How do you think he's going to be doing in New York, or how do you feel like he's done so far in the off season?
I think so far he's done great, and he's going to even be better. I have predicted in print and to Phil and to Derek Fisher that they're going to win a championship in 3 years.
In 3 years?
3 years.
Wow. Does that involve a big free agent catch by the 2016
yes.
season?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes. Obviously, with the current roster, I think this year, assuming they don't make any major trades, which they may, I would think they would finish sixth seed in the East.
So Phil Jackson
lose in the first round.
Absolutely. Phil Jackson, like we already talked about, he's one of your closest friends. The other thing that's interesting, and I wanted to get this out the way too, is that Mr. Rosen would actually have a lot of experience with maybe showing Derek Fisher what Phil Jackson would be like as a coach, because not only did he co-write books with Phil Jackson, he was also an assistant coach under Phil Jackson in the Continental Basketball Association in the CBA for a team called the Albany...
Patroons.
the
Albany Patroons. UB Brown used to call it the Albany Macaroons.
The Albany Macaroons. Well, they didn't play like macaroons. Y'all won a CBA championship.
And we did. We did in 1984, before you were born, yes?
About 2 years after. So I'm still wearing the diapers by that point. But I was also curious because I know Bill Musselman, who was one of the other coaching pioneers of the CBA after Phil. Did you coach under Musselman mm-hmm. as well?
Not under him. I coached against him. And that was an experience. If I may, I was the head coach of the Savannah Spirits, and Mus was coaching the Tampa Bay Thrillers. And we were playing, and I think they won the championship that year. So anyway, during the regular season, we're playing at Tampa Bay, and we had a player named Cedric Henderson, played a little bit for the Atlanta Hawks. He was out of Georgia. And we were right there, and the referee, Jim Wishmeyer, I'll never forget his name, called like three charging fouls on Cedric Henderson in like the last 90 seconds, and Tampa Bay won the game on the last buzzer beater by Fast Eddie Johnson. So Tampa Bay won in their home court. So the referees run off the court, and I'm walking off the court, and Musselman charges over to the referee's locker room, and they kind of slam the door in his face, and he starts pounding on the door and kicking the door and screaming and cursing. And he said, "You stole the game from Charlie. You stole the game." Banging on the door. And I said, "Mus, take it easy. You know, you feel worse than I do." And I lost the game.
Well, Musselman had...
"Take it easy. Take it easy." He said, "If I don't win a game fair, I don't want to win it."
Well, Musselman did have a fire personality. A lot of people had said that you had had a little bit of an outlandish personality as well as a head coach, but you also transitioned that into some other books of your own. You did one called Crazy Basketball, A Life in and Out of Bounds. You also did, I couldn't believe this one, you did an autobiography with Daryl Dawkins, Chocolate Thunder. So, Mr. Rosenstein.
That was a trip also. He's extremely intelligent, and he's legitimately funny. He doesn't have like straight lines that are on a tape. You know, he responds to the situation, and he's just a good person. He's friendly to strangers. He's really a wonderful guy. We had a great time doing that book.
A terrific personality. That's why I think he transitioned so well as an out off the court, and even in later years, and he's able to communicate so well with even younger fans. He's just got that great, because I remember watching him on that. Have you seen that anthology series, MB 80s, where he does the talking head?
No, I don't watch television too much.
Well, he did some of the talking heads things for those. And I mean, it's still there. Like the magnetism is definitely still there with Chocolate Thunder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Phil Jackson, he played underneath some New York Knicks teams that were coached by Red Holtzman. There's actually going to be an ESPN documentary coming out pretty soon called When the Garden Was Eden, directed by famous actor Michael Rapaport. That's concerning the New York Knicks teams that won the NBA championships both in 1970, and they also won in the 1972-73 season. That also brings us to the topic of the book that we are going to be talking about with Mr. Rosen, because that was the exact same season in which the Philadelphia 76ers suffered through statistically the worst season in the history of NBA basketball. Now, this has been matched in terms of, or actually surpassed in terms of losing percentage or lack of winning percentage by the Charlotte Bobcats in 2012. But you made an impassioned plea in your introduction that you still think the Sixers were a worser team than the Bobcats. How is that?
Well, they played, the Bobcats played fewer games, and if they, you know, could, conceivably they could have won another game, they would have played, what, another 15. And I think at the same point in the Sixers season that year, if the 66 games, I think they had a worse record. I don't quite remember.
In terms of winning percentage, they were slightly worse. Slightly worse.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, the 73 Sixers, I mean, you can't even make up all the circumstances that sort of led to how bad they were. It was amazing because, you know, leading up to that point, they had had one of the best records in NBA history. I don't remember which year it was. I think it was in the late 60s, but they had a team that was selected.
69, 60. I think it was 69, Chamberlain, and they won a championship. And, yeah, they were one of the, arguably one of the best teams in the history of the NBA.
Yeah, and it seemed like everything kind of went downhill in a hurry after they introduced the Philadelphia Spectrum in 68. They made maybe the worst trade in the history of sports. They traded Chamberlain for Archie Clark, Daryl Imhoff, and Jerry Chambers. They let Chet Walker.
Well, he wanted out. Chamberlain wanted out. He said he had a verbal agreement with Milt Richmond, who was one of the co-owners of the team, for Chamberlain to re-sign a contract and get a piece of the team. But then Richmond died, and Irv Kozloff was the remaining owner, and he didn't honor what Chamberlain said was a verbal agreement, so Chamberlain wanted out. They had to make that trade.
And that was part of him threatening to go to the ABA? And then they felt like that they felt like they were sort of handcuffed and they had to make the deal. I mean, you make what you can with the deal, but you know, at some point you get to a point where you realize that you didn't get that much in return. But they tried to survive it, and unfortunately they didn't for the 73 season.
So they lost Cunningham too. They lost their best player, who jumped to the Carolina Cougars in the ABA, and the. It was a lawsuit that dragged on for almost the whole season, but Cunningham, while the litigation was going on, did play for the Cougars. So, he was their best player, and he was gone.
Chet Walker was gone. The one that stuck around, who was also voted on one of the top 50 NBA players of all time in 97, that was Hal Greer. Now, Hal Greer at that point was 37 years old, and, you know, Father Time was knocking on his door. Was it sad to kind of detail how he had turned into a player of almost, of about the least significance that he had ever been in his career in the season?
Well, he did have some gas in his tank, though. He played a little bit. Roy Rubin was the first coach, and that's another story. Roy Rubin's bio and incompetent. He's probably the worst coach who ever coached in the NBA, although Jerry Tarkanian would give him a run for it. So Greer did have something left, and in the beginning of the season, he played okay, but there was a big controversy. The coach at the time, Roy Rubin, said, well, he had to go with young players, and Greer's agent said, yes, but you promised he was going to play, and then the Philadelphia management said, well, we offered to make him an assistant coach, and they said, no, you didn't, and it kind of went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and he was one of the guys, he just didn't want to talk about that season. It was a very bitter experience for him.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
Even when Kevin Lockery took over after Rubin was 4-48, he didn't play Greer much either. He just had to go with the young kids just to see what if there was any future for this team.
Yeah, that's the one thing I wanted to ask you about. Also, obviously, when you have a team that that has that bad of a record. You have players that are capable of at least getting the NBA, but maybe not capable of doing much after that. Some of the names include guys like John Block, Jeff Halliburton, John Trapp, Manny Leakes, Dave Sorensen, Don May, Leroy Ellis, Fred Mad Dog Carter, players that were able to get into the NBA as journeymen, but as a collective unit, were capable. When you were interviewing some of the people who were still alive when you did this book, were they still pretty bitter memories for them, or did they look at it more like the Bad News Bears?
No, they kind of have looked back fondly, I think. Freddie Carter, and a lot of them said they hope nobody breaks their record. You know, and the one thing that I got was they played hard. They didn't go belly up like the Bobcats did quite often that year, and they weren't at each other's throats like the Bobcats were. I mean, it was a different world. You know, nowadays everybody has a smartphone, and there are no secrets.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you know, how many NBA games were televised? There was a game of the week on a weekend or something, and the West Coast, championship game on the West Coast, it was showed the next morning or something like that. There wasn't as much of a public recognition of the NBA. It was what's happening in New York, what's happening in Chicago, what's happening in Los Angeles, as far as those NBA teams. And everybody else, forget it. No, you know, nobody really knew what was going on. So these guys played with a certain degree of anonymity. It wasn't like a whole celebrated thing. So they, in a way, there was less pressure on them, in a way. And they played, for most games, they played really well for three quarters, but they didn't have the depth. They couldn't make stops in the fourth quarter. And the Knicks won the championship that year, and they beat the Knicks.
I saw that.
That was 114-19. They beat the Knicks.
I saw that.
Right. And, you know, I spoke to Phil Jackson about that, and he said, well, you know, Red Holtzman was telling us we've got to be mentally ready. Any team can beat anybody, blah, blah, blah. And Phil said, well, the players were just kind of, yeah. All we have to do is step on the court, and those guys are going to just, lie down. And it wasn't the case. So they were not, you know, if they would have had a good coach, I think if they would have played today with a good coach, they would win 15 games.
Well,
league was tougher then. There weren't as many teams.
Yeah, only 17.
Yeah, it was tougher.
Mm-hmm. And they, like you had mentioned, they went 4-47 under Roy Rubin, who had been a coach at Long Island University, but never had any pro experience and never coached again after the Philadelphia campaign. So they were 4-47 when Kevin Lowry took over. Lowry was actually, he became a coach later strictly for the Nets and the Hawks, and he was Michael Jordan's first coach in the NBA. But little do people know that he was a player coach in the last part of that season.
Well, he was theoretically a player coach. The owner, surviving owner, Kozlov, insisted that he get dressed in a uniform, but he had hurt his knee, and he never got on the court when he was a player coach. But Kevin is one of the best people in all of basketball. He's honest. He's the kind of guy you'd love to have a beer with. He's straight with you. He has no airs. A lot of guys have that, even 50 years later or whatever, they still have that NBA glow. He's just a regular guy. He's a great guy. I don't think he has an enemy in the world. I can't conceive of him having an enemy. He's just a great guy.
The last coach to win an ABA championship in 1976 with the Nets. Let me ask you this. If Roy Rubin had not been fired, do you think they would have won 5 of 7 games in February?
No. They probably would have won maybe one more game, two more games. He was, I mean, he didn't know what he's doing. He'd come into the locker room at halftime and say, okay, play hard, play hard, play hard. how much time left before we have to go back on the court? He do things like that. He had nothing to say to them. He was a good high school coach. He's an excellent high school coach at Columbus High School in the Bronx, where I'm from. I knew him slightly back in those days. And when he got to LIU, he was a good coach, but he was kind of a control freak. He'd recruit all these guys who can run and jump and fast break and play fast pace, and he kind of slowed it down. He imposed his will, his personality on his players, but they weren't the right kind of players. He recruited the best athletes he could, and then he kind of tied them down. Something like Luke Karnaseca used to do at St. John's.
Oh, with the what did he used to wear? He used to wear the sweater, right? He wore the sweater.
That little sweater, yeah. He's a fraud.
Here's a good trivia for a lot of people. The last game they won was on February 28th. They beat the Baltimore Bullets 102-96. The coach of that Baltimore Bullets team was actually the coach who replaced Lowry after that season, Gene Shue. Do you think Gene Shue was the first part of the turnaround for the Sixers after that season, or would you particularly point it to getting Julius Erving?
Oh, they didn't get Julius Erving until later. Mm-hmm. Doug Collins was their number one draft pick, and he helped them, but they cleared the roster. And Gene Shue, he's another one of the wonderful people in NBA history. You know, just another great guy, and he could tailor his game plan to the players he had. And he was great at devising isolation situations, and where it was difficult to double team these guys. And he was really good at doing that. And he eventually took him to a finals.
You know, yeah, that 77 team.
He's a hell of a coach. He's a hell of a coach.
That 77.
An underrated coach. You know, and he specialized. Gene Shue specialized and taking really, really bad teams and turning them into winners. So his lifetime record, I believe, is under 500. But that just shows you how little you can gain about a coach's skills by his record. He's a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, a guy who you always reminded me of was Dick Motta. Dick Motta had a lot of teams like that where they were kind of struggling through. I think the Bullets team that won the NBA championship in 78 that Motta coached, I think they were the worst regular season record of all time for a team that won the NBA championship. Gene Shue developed a team you were talking about in 1977 when they lost to the Blazers. That's one of the best teams ever, but a lot of people don't remember them because they lost the finals. If they had won it, they'd
right.
be right there at the top of the crop for every retrospective you ever see.
Right.
Let me ask you
and
this.
Gene Shue was a real good player, too.
Mm-hmm.
He's a 20-point scorer. He played with the Pistons. He also played with the Knicks. I wonder where he is now. I haven't spoken to him in a long, long time.
I'm not
Gene, sure. If you hear this, call me.
We're going to have to get Gene. I'm going to have to get Gene on the podcast after this one because I'd like to talk to him. Let me ask you this. You wrote a book about the 71-72 LA Los Angeles Lakers. The LA Lakers won 69 games. That record was later broken by the Bulls, but only until like 20 years later. A lot of people had considered the 71-72 Lakers the greatest team in NBA history because of how great they were in the regular season along with winning a championship. What fascinated you about writing a book not about a team 1 year later that was so bad compared to writing a team about a team that was so good?
Well, I like the juxtaposition. And that Lakers team won. I like the juxtaposition of the best team and the worst team. But that Lakers team also won 33 games in a row, I believe. And they were just, they had everything. They had you know, from coaching to depth, they could play any style of ball. Bill Sharman was a coach. They could run. They could play half court. They could play defense. I think that they were better than Jordan's teams, better than the other Magic Johnson's Lakers. I mean, I think, and I've been watching basketball. I remember George Mikan.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, guys like that. I mean, I think that this is the best team ever.
Well, my dad absolutely loved Gail Goodrich. He always told me he was the best pure shooter he ever saw.
Stumpy. Stumpy, they called him. Yeah, a little lefty. He was 6'1", and he could drive and get his shot off. I mean, it's amazing. He just kept on doing it. Everybody's like, you know, look at this guy. He's slow. He can't jump. He's this little guy. How does he? He just did it. He just found the spaces.
Yeah.
He just found the spaces.
Have a little slight ill will for him. Not his fault. Just a business end because I'm a New Orleanian and the Jazz were on the receiving end of a pretty one sided trade in which we got an old broken down Goodrich and the Lakers got Magic Johnson and every draft pick known to man. So. But Gail Goodrich in the early 70s, fantastic player. He was one of the key guys on that Lakers team. The Sixers team didn't really have a key player. I think the most recognizable face for most people today would probably be Fred the Mad Dog Carter. I always found it fascinating, though, that they called him the Mad Dog because when I would watch him on certain shows where he was an analyst, like on ESPN2, NBA TV, he seemed like such a nice, generous man. Where did he get that nickname?
Well, he had some real good years with the old Baltimore Bullets, and he hit a big shot in a Eastern Conference Finals game that beat the Knicks. That was a big rivalry. And when he was a rookie, the Bullets used to have a drill. They played one-on-one, and it was a kind of a revolving thing, so the guards guarded the big men guarded the guards when that rotation happened. And so Carter was a rookie, and he's out there, and he's playing this savage defense, and he's just killing everybody until Cenk Scott gets out there, Ray Scott, and who was like, what, 6'9", 260, and Carter was 6'1", 200, and Scott just backed him in and backed him in and backed him in, and Carter couldn't stop him, so he bit Scott on the shoulder. Just bit him.
Oh, wow.
And they called him Mad Dog. His friends call him Doggy.
Well, we
he's also a great guy. He's also and he was voted the MVP of that team. He averaged 20 points a game. And they gave him a trophy. He said he's put in his closet. He doesn't even know where it is. But there's another thing involving Carter, who's a black guy, and Ruben was the coach. And to show you that racism was a viable thing, was an active thing in the NBA in that time. The coaches used to vote for the All-Star players. You could vote for anybody except somebody on your team. And Roy Rubin called the other coaches around the league and said, don't vote for Freddie Carter.
Oh, wow.
So they voted for John Black, who was a 6'9", 6'10", white guy, who was an okay player, had one good year. He could shoot. He was slow. He couldn't really play defense. You know, he was a good, solid player, but not an all-star. And he was white. So the white guy made the team, and the black guys on the Sixers were really convinced that the whole thing was just a racial situation, and they weren't too happy with Ruben. They weren't too happy with Ruben to begin with, but that kind of
that was the straw that broke the camel's back a little bit.
Well, sort of. I mean, he was 4-48 actually at the All-Star break when he was fired. But they just they had no respect for him. That was just another reason for them not to respect Ruben. He would do things like if player A passed the ball to player B, who had an open shot but missed, Ruben would get on player A, why did you pass him the ball?
Wow.
Why did I pass him the ball? Like I knew he was going to miss the shot. He didn't know what he was doing. He was just out of his league.
A direct quote from Fred Carter, he said about Ruben, he said, like letting a teenager run a big corporation. So just to give you about as apt of a comparison about how badly led of a team that they were, also given the fact that they didn't really have a lot of talent to begin with. The one fascinating part of that season I wanted you to – because I know you wrote – because we talked about how you wrote about the Lakers is that there were two players that had played on that 71-72 team that were traded midway in the 72-73 season to Philadelphia. That was the late Leroy Ellis and John Trapp. But how was that for them?
How did that what?
How was that for them? That must have been feel like going from the penthouse to the outhouse.
Oh, well, Ellis, you know, he played, he ran up and down, he had a good time no matter what he was doing. And that was John Q. Trapp. His middle name was Quincy, he said, because his parents thought he might be president, like John Quincy Adams. he was a character. Actually, I played against Leroy in the World Senior Games about 20 years ago, my God. Rest in peace, Leroy. So John Q. Trapp, there was a writer, a beat writer for one of the Philadelphia papers who followed the Sixers. And he said, I was in combat in Vietnam, but John Q. Trapp scares me more than at any time I was in Vietnam. He was a scary guy. And he'd do things like when he was with the Lakers, he was late for a flight, and he knew that he'd have to pay his own fare to wherever they were going and have to pay a fine. So he solved his problem by calling a bomb threat into the airport. So he delayed everything. When he got there, things were okay.
Oh, my goodness.
But the famous story was he's from Detroit, right? So he's... they're playing, and he has all his buddies. He got him seats right in back of the Philly bench. So there's a timeout, and Ruben comes over to him, and he says, Dave Sorensen, go in for Trapp. Trapp says, no, I'm not coming out of the game. Ruben says, what are you talking about? And, you know, he's making a substitution. So Trapp turns around, looks at his guys. One of them stands up, opens his jacket, and shows a gun.
Oh, my goodness.
And Ruben says, okay, you stay. The last game, Kevin Lockery, the last game that Kevin was a player, he's sitting on the bench, and he's sitting next to Trapp, and Trapp gets a cup from the water cooler, and he has one of those little bottles of booze you get on the airlines. He gets stashed in his sock, mm-hmm. and he pours it into your cup. He says, here, Kevin, you want a sip? So one of the first things Kevin did when he became a head coach was to cut Trapp. And when he did, he made the announcement on a bus trip, and all the players applauded.
Who would you rather be stuck in a room with, John Q. Trapp or the late Marvin Barnes?
Well, I think Barnes was more liable, or would be more liable to hurt me. I don't know. I'd like to see the two of them stuck in a room. That would be even more interesting.
Marvin Barnes just recently passed away. Justin Rosero is actually one of my main hosts on the or one of the main hosts for the Place to Be Nation. He's a Providence grad, and that was as much as enigmatic of.
Wait. Let me tell you. I'm sorry. One last John Q. Trapp story. Mm-hmm. I was told he died, and I looked up on the internet, and I subscribed to all these different websites, and I couldn't find his name. His brother, he had a brother, George Trapp, who also played in the NBA. He was the good Trapp, and I couldn't find any indication, any listing that John Q. had died. But as several people told me that he passed away, okay, so I wrote in the book that he deceased. I had the occasion to talk to Kevin Lockery after the book was published, and he told me what he heard was that John Q. changed his name and is living out there somewhere, and nobody knows where. But he's still alive, living under a different name.
Oh, wow.
Which kind of makes you wonder, why did he do that?
And that name, that name is Pete Carroll. It's funny that I didn't know that about John Trapp having a brother, because the Sixers had one of the players was one of the Van Arsdale twins, Tom Van Arsdale. That's interesting.
Yeah, the Van Arsdales are also wonderful guys, really, cornpone guys from Indiana. I had interviewed Dick for some book I wrote, I don't remember, and then I interviewed Tom for this book. What I did is, I reported on the season and stuck in some contemporary quotes from some of the players, but after describing the season, I did a whole thing about where these guys are now and what memories they have of that season. So, but the Van Arsdales were like identical twins and fiercely competitive. Their father,
very good players.
Very good players. When they were teenagers, the father built a basket in the backyard, and they used to play. But they would play until one-on-one until each of them had won the same number of games, because if they didn't, they would go crazy. Everything had to be even. They were really very competitive. Who was best? Who was best? The mother had to give them the exact same amount of cereal and everything. They're really competitive.
Oh, wow.
So I spoke to Tom, and Dick had a stroke several years ago, but he's in pretty good shape. He can walk around, and he can drive, and he can paint and play golf and stuff. He's in pretty good shape. But they're still inseparable. So I was talking to Tom, his recollections about that season, and we were finished. He said, "Hey, do you have anything you want to say to Dick? He's right here." So I said, no, that's okay. So he turns around and says, "Hey, Dick, this guy said that I was a better player than you." still at it.
The fire is still there.
Still there, yeah.
I'll always remember. I think Dick Van Arsdale, I think, was the one that played for the Suns in the 76 finals with Paul Westphal and Gar Hurd and them. And I'll never forget him because, I think he had the kind of longish hair, but he just wouldn't quit. He was just like Westphal.
Right.
They would just be flying around all over the place. And they were in that classic triple overtime game in 76.
Right.
Let me ask
the
about...
Two of them played, the last year that they played in the NBA, both of them played for Phoenix.
Oh, wow.
And the guys guarding them would get, "Who am I guarding? Who am I supposed to guard? This guy, that guy, who?" And it would wind up several times. Two defenders would be guarding one in Van Arsdale. They just get so confused.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were in opposite teams and they played each other, they kind of step back and let the brother score.
Yeah. I wonder, the Suns have twins like that with Markeith and Marcus Morris, and sometimes I wonder if they have the same situations where refs can't remember which one had the foul and which one they have to put into a game plan because they don't know which one. Even though they're slightly different in size, I always thought about that because you don't see a lot of twins in the NBA, and the Van Arsdales were one and the Morris twins are now the other. I want to ask about you in this way. You've done quite a few nonfiction books about basketball, but you've also written quite a few novels about basketball. I'm particularly enamored with the title, The Cockroach Basketball Association, the one you wrote in 1992. Is there one that you take more umbrage with that you like to do more? Do you like writing fiction over nonfiction?
Doing nonfiction is easier, and it's more fun. Because there's stuff there to write about, and because there's somebody to interview, and a lot of times, I just did something for ESPN.com that'll be printed right before the season starts about people's reaction to the Spurs winning the championship and how they won the championship, and that was the same thing. It gave me a chance to speak to guys that I knew when I was living in New York and going to a lot of games and writing for Sport Magazine and Inside Sports and several other magazines, and I was kind of on the circuit. And I knew a lot of guys. I don't know any of the today's players, but I was able to reconnect with guys like Willis Reed and Jack Maron and Kevin Lockery and John McLaughlin and a whole bunch of guys like that. Mike Reardon, guys I was pretty friendly with. I did a story on Mike Reardon. I did a story on Jack Maron way back. So it's just fun reconnecting with those guys. Whereas a novel, it's your imagination. So it's more difficult, but I enjoy it more because I can fantasize. I love to fantasize and create a situation that is organic, at least to me, and that, you know, that comes alive, and I can get I kind of get sucked into it. I get more personally involved, more emotionally involved with writing a novel. But it's also with writing a novel, at least, again, just for me, I don't know how it's going to end. You know, if you know how it's going to end, you kind of restrict yourself. You limit the possibilities of your own imagination. So it's like, where is this going to happen next? And if the novel works, and believe me, I've written plenty of novels that just didn't work and I never finished them, or finished them and threw them out or something like that. But the ones that work for me, it's just curiosity. Well, what's going to be the next logical thing to happen? And then what's going to happen next? And where is this all going to wind up? So it's more of a creative adventure, going into the unknown, which is a lot of fun, which I enjoy a lot.
Yeah, but the truth can be stranger than fiction sometimes. So I bet going back into that nonfiction genre and recollecting with a lot of those people that you had mentioned, I bet that could be a lot of fun too, because you find out things that you just never would have even imagined were true, like the gun incident with John Q. Trapp. I can't even believe that's even possible. But to be honest, in 70s NBA, anything's possible. I could believe any of it.
There are crazier things than that, you know, especially with Roy Rubin when the first year that he coached at LIU, Long Island University. What year was that? 61, 62. That was my senior year playing in Hunter College. So I played against him that first year. And his best player at LAU was a guy named Barry Leibowitz, who wound up playing, was drafted by Golden State, I think, played for three NBA teams in one season, and then went to Israel and played. He was a terrific, but he was definitely an NBA caliber ball player. You know, I played against him a couple times. Really, 6'5" guard, point guard who could do everything. So Barry was going into his senior year when Ruben was in his first year. So Ruben had, you know, he had to have a good team that year. And the Denver team of the ABA had already signed Spencer Haywood.
Denver Rockets.
As an undergraduate. Yeah. Denver Rockets.
Yeah, I remember that.
And the NBA would not allow them to sign anybody until their class had graduated. And the ABA was running around looking for guys to undergraduates to sign. And they were sniffing around Barry Leibowitz. So Ruben is freaking out. So he goes over to Barry before the school started. He said, "What do I have to do to keep you with LIU this year?" So Barry says, "Provide me with a hooker the night before every game." And that's what he did.
Wow.
And there are even crazier stories involving Ruben at LIU. He was really a wacko. He had no business coaching in the NBA, but nobody wanted to coach that team, Philadelphia. They were really heading down. He had won 30 games the year before. Jack Ramsey was the coach. He said this team has no future, and he left. They had to put an advertisement in the newspaper to get a new coach.
Yeah.
Wanted coach for an NBA team. Inquire, you know, here's the phone number.
Well, the rumor was that they had offered it to Adolph Rupp and Al McGuire, but they both said no.
Well, Al McGuire wanted a lot of money up front. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'll coach. I'll do it. But I want to be the GM. I want to do everything. I want to have power over everything. And give me, I'm just making this sum up. I don't know what it is. Give me $100,000 up front soon as I put my name on the contract. They approach Red Holtzman. They approach a million people.
You're very well traveled, obviously, with all the different topics that you've written about, all the teams that you've been a part of, not only in with the NBA but the CBA and such. But I wonder, do you have a favorite team, or do you have a favorite school that you root for every year as every NBA season comes up?
I pay very little attention to college basketball. The refereeing is atrocious. The coaching is not nearly up to what happens in the NBA. There are maybe one or two really good players on each team, and I just don't get excited. I don't even watch the Final Four. I'd be hard pressed to tell you who won the championship last year. I really wouldn't know.
You're not alone.
But the NBA, you know, people say it's boring, but it's not boring. It's a little too dependent on high pick and rolls, but there are a lot of reasons why they do that. They do it because the guy setting the pick, watch his hands. His hands are low. He'll push the back of the guy he's picking. He'll make some contact with him. Also, it's two-on-two basketball, so the referees can see any fouls. They're not screened out. And usually fouls are called on the defense. And they also run that because the young kids coming in today don't know how to play five-on-five basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of have to simplify.
Yeah, they got that triple. They got that double AU game in them.
Yeah, which is terrible. I mean, the AAU, they just cater to these kids. These kids don't learn anything. But you know, aside from that, I mean, Kevin Lockery said if he sees one more high pick and roll, he's going to vomit on the TV set. but still, it's just these guys are such great athletes, and the coaching is so good. It's so good, which is why I love to watch playoff series in the NBA. because you can see the adjustments. You can really see it in a seven-game series, how each coaching staff makes these small adjustments to try and counter what the other team is doing, and then there are counter adjustments during the regular season, teams play each other once a month or something like that, so they really can't do an in-depth scouting report. They can do a scouting report. They have somebody, one of the assistant coaches or an advanced scout, following teams, but they can't make the kind of adjustments. They play one game, okay, I can see you in another month. But when you're playing like every other day or whatever, the same team, and you have time to focus on the other team and see what their third options are, their fourth options are, and you have time to practice, it's a human chess game. And the deeper you go into the playoffs, the better the competition is, and the more subtle are the adjustments, and the more necessary are the adjustments that the coaching staffs make. So playoff basketball is just terrific. I love it. NBA playoff basketball.
So I would say that, obviously, based on what you said about the article that you're going to have coming out on ESPN, that you took a lot of delight in watching how the San Antonio Spurs played under Greg Popovich.
I loved it. That's the way basketball is supposed to be played. Move the ball, move the bodies, rotate flawlessly on defense. And Pop is like a stickler for defense. Danny Green, in one of the games, hits two threes and then makes a mistake on defense, takes him right out of the game, sits mm-hmm. him down.
Yeah.
And he comes back in, hits another three, makes another mistake on defense, takes him out, gets in his face.
Yeah.
Chews him out.
The Spurs are...
And then after a minute or so later, puts them back in. You know, everybody knows their role. During the regular season last year, nobody on that team played as much as 30 minutes. He uses the whole squad. So he trusts the guys off the bench, and they respond. And by playing them, they're ready to play meaningful minutes.
And their field goal efficiency is so incredible.
Well, they get open shots. you know, there's a difference between taking a shot under pressure or taking an open shot. You take an open shot, you generally shoot 20% better. And they create open shots, but they don't. A lot of other teams create open shots by driving and dishing. You know, you drive, you draw a crowd, and then you kick it out. But you can defend that. Smart teams can defend that. But when it's just movement and movement and movement and movement and movement, it just leaves guys open. And they also have Boris Diaw, who used to be a point guard when he first came into the league. And he played a very underrated role in that series. He was a facilitator. He made passes when they double-teamed somebody. He jumped to the around the free throw line.
He was
and
kind of a point
when you're
forward.
In the middle of the court, yeah, you can pass left, you can pass right, you can do whatever you want. And he was, and plus you could post up. He was a key player for them.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about the coaching, because it's not necessarily an insult to the coaches of the past, but it does feel like a lot of the coaches are either getting smarter as to how certain players play and how they work together, but also going to a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, and trying to keep the continuity of the team without, you know, trying to just go to the same old routine. Even though, you know, Kevin Lockery's right, they do a lot of high ball screens, they run horns a lot. It seems like you see more of the same, but they do a lot of deviations out of that. So I'm glad that you said that. I think even for teams like LeBron's team, like Carmelo's team, which is now Derek Fisher's team under Phil Jackson, even teams with star-centric, you know, or big-time superstars, you do see a lot of creativity within those teams. I mean, Michael Jordan didn't win all those titles by himself, you know?
Yeah, but the tendency and the one thing that the message that the Spurs championship demonstrates is that five players can beat three players, is that basketball is 5-on-5. And too many coaches play to their stars. And fans want to see, they want to see LeBron score 40 points and dunk the ball four or five times. You know, everybody used to say, and they probably still do, how boring San Antonio is. That was the word. They're boring, their ratings are low, they're boring, they're boring. You're boring because people... John McLaughlin said people are just interested in glitz. You know, they want the fancy pass, they want the this, they want that. They're not really interested in sound, brilliantly played basketball. And, you know, other teams have been fundamentally sound, but the difference with San Antonio, aside from their personnel, is how quickly they play. The ball can be passed, can move faster than a defensive player can move.
It's almost like they're running three half-court sets at the same time.
Yes, there's always weak side movement, as there is in a triangle, so it's difficult to help, to know when to help, and everybody just accepts their role. It's wonderful to watch. Pop is a wonderful coach.
I'm going to wrap you up with two questions here.
Sure.
Let me ask you this. What will we see? You're going to have to choose between the two, even though both of them might not be possible in the future. But which one do you think we would see first? A team with 73 or more losses or a team with 72 or more victories?
I don't think you see either. You know, with the travel, there are 30 teams. Back-to-back games, all this nonsense about cutting the games down is ridiculous. It's never going to happen. Shortening the games, it's never going to happen. There's too much money at stake. A player's going to take a pay cut if they play fewer games, if they play fewer minutes. It's not going to happen. Because of free agency, and because there are so many games, you can't really build the kind of continuity that the Bulls had, that San Antonio has, to win 70 plus games. I don't think that's going to happen anymore. And I think that the season is so long, and there are so many back to back games that bad teams are going to catch a break. you know, their wins, they may be coming off a 2 days rest, and a better team is playing back-to-back or playing the fourth game in 5 days or something like that, and they can sneak a win. So I think both of those records are safe.
That's how the Sixers beat the Knicks. They beat them on a back-to-back where they went to New York and then they went back to Philly and they beat them in the second game. So you're absolutely right,
and
about
that. They beat Milwaukee. They beat Milwaukee also.
On Valentine's Day.
Winter Bar. Yeah.
I always like to throw this one just to show my nerdery to any friends. I always tell them that the Bulls were, you know, 72-10 in 96, and then they went 69-13 in 97. But I always tell them the Toronto Raptors beat them twice in both of those seasons, because you just never know what. You know, sometimes you wake up and you're just not feeling right, you know, as a team as a whole. And you're absolutely right about that. That's why I think a lot of those all-time records, the 33-game winning streak, the 72-10 season, the 9-73 season for the Philadelphia 76ers, I just think those are just untouchable. So I think you're right.
Right. When Jerry West coached his short, unsuccessful stint coaching the Lakers, every game he would tell his guys, this is the most important game of the season. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. It's too long a season. I mean, when Phil was coaching, even when he was coaching the Bills, he didn't mind losing a game here or there. You know, lose a game. It's okay. It's good to prevent the guys from getting too cocky, to keep them serious, to make sure their game preparation is what it should be. So, you know, losses can be okay. It's such a long season. It is such a grind. You know, guys get hurt. All kinds of things happen. It's tough.
Yeah, you would have to have that. You would have to have that laser focus all year long. And it's just the only reason I think that happened in '96 was because Michael had lost to the Magic, and he felt like he had something to prove every single night. And Scottie did too, and Rodman did too, because he had just left the Spurs. And I mean, that's Phil Jackson's masterpiece. I mean, it's unbelievable that he's only won Coach of the Year once or twice, but that was
That
was
his masterpiece. Mm-hmm. His masterpiece was the year that Jordan was playing baseball. And they ran the triangle to perfection. And if it wasn't for that bogus call in the playoffs against the Knicks,
the Hubert Davis foul,
yes, they would have gone to the finals, and who knows what would have happened. That was the best job he's done as a coach.
Final question. They were talking on a recent episode of one of these back-and-forth debate shows on NBA TV where a lot of older players talk and just have a conversation called Open Court. And they were talking about the NBA's 50 all-time players, and we're going to be doing a podcast pretty soon about, you know, players in the later years that you can add. But since we're talking about players of the past, I want to ask you this. If you had to add two or three players into that NBA all-time 50 that didn't make it, who would you make a case for?
Well, I don't have the list in front of me. Is Dave DeBuscher on the list?
Dave DeBuscher is on the list. You want me to give you a quick list just to give you a...
No. If Dave DeBuscher is not on the list, he should be on the list. If Gus Johnson is not on the list, he should be on the list.
Johnson's not on the list.
He should be on the list. Is DeBuscher on the list? DeBuscher has to be
DeBuscher
on the list.
DeBuscher is, yes.
Okay, and Johnson, you know, there wasn't much to choose between the two of them. One of them played in the media capital of the world. They're both great players. I'm a big DeBuscher fan. And Johnson was a little more of a dynamic player. His role was a little different, but he should have been on that list.
A lot of the ones they talked about on that show, one of them was Dominique Wilkins. The other one was Bob McAdoo. Those were, I mean, great players. The one that I was always thinking about, and he was a great ABA player, which may have hurt him a little bit because his stats in the NBA weren't as much, but I thought he was definitely one of the best ever. Dan Issel, that's a guy that I would have definitely considered.
Yeah, I mean, he was okay. He was smart. He was tough. He was a shooter. He was a poor man's Bob Pettit. I wouldn't say he was one of the 50 best.
Yeah, it's tough to squeeze him out, though. But
yeah, but, you know, it's also games are different. Different eras, different. The game is different. You know, if Michael Jordan played today, he averaged 50 points a game. You can't play defense today. You can't put your hands on a guy.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's really tough to compare players from different eras and to rank them when the game has changed so much.
Well, Mr. Rosen, I thank you so much for doing this interview with me.
Sure.
It's so much fun. Again, for everybody, please buy his book, Perfectly Awful, The Philadelphia 76ers Horrendous and Hilarious 1972-73 Season. He also writes for USA Today's Hoops Hype internet column.
No, I don't. I don't write for Hoops Hype anymore.
Oh,
I write
stopped?
For ESPN.com.
I
haven't written for, yeah.
When
scratch that. He writes for ESPN.com.
Was that recent for ESPN?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And I've written two things, but they won't be published till closer to the season.
Well, please read all the columns from ESPN columnist Charlie Rosen. But do you have anything else to plug? Any other books?
Well, you know, I got 20 of them. Buy 20 copies of each.
That would be more than the
number. No, just enjoy the season. All I can say is enjoy the season and hope the seventh game of the finals goes to triple overtime. That's what every basketball fan should hope for.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, on behalf of Charlie Rosen, this is Andrew Reich. We'll see you all again, guys.